This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Next week, South Africa celebrates the 10th anniversary of its first democratic election. Despite many problems, the country has coped with the aftermath of apartheid much better than many feared. National elections last week, for example, were widely regarded as free and fair. The African National Congress won nearly 70% of the vote. Enormous disparities remain in almost everything measurable: income, education, housing, health care. But there is measurable progress, too. Perhaps most important, the country has not dissolved in hatred and revenge. Much of the credit for that belongs to a remarkable institution, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was established in 1995 to provide a mechanism for confession and forgiveness, to give both victims and perpetrators an opportunity to speak and make amends. Later in the program, we revisit the violence at Columbine High School and see why it happened. But first, the legacy of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What's gone right, what hasn't, and what lessons can we learn not just about alternative judicial methods, but about human nature? Our telephone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Pumla Gobodo-Madikizela, an associate professor of psychology at the University of Cape Town. She was a member of the Human Rights Violations Committee for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Her book, A Human Being Died That Night, A South African Woman Confronts the Legacy of Apartheid, was released in paperback this week. It's good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Good afternoon.
Can you give us a bit of history? How did the Truth and Reconciliation Commission come about in the first place?
When the negotiations between the parties, political parties in South Africa, ended, they ended that phase by establishing an interim constitution that was formulating many of the laws that frame human rights culture in South Africa today. The end of that process was to state very unequivocally the need to establish a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. This was part of the Constitution, and so at the end of December in 1995, a law was promulgated in Parliament passing the laws, the rules that were formulating procedures for establishing the commission. So after that process, on the 15th of December, the commission opened its doors, its offices in Cape Town.
And how many people overall, both perpetrators and victims, appeared before the commission?
More than 22,000 victims submitted their testimonies before the commission, but only about 10% of those appeared in public. For perpetrators, submissions were about 9,000, between 7,000 and 9,000. But overall, about 250 of those were valid applications, by which I mean to say that they were they fell within the mandate of the commission. The rest were cast out, and so all of those perpetrators appeared before the public testimonies of the Truth Commission over a period of about 3 years.
Now, tell us a little bit more about what qualified someone who was a perpetrator to come before the commission. Clearly, there were people whose crimes were so heinous. Certainly, it didn't supplant criminal prosecutions, did it?
No, it didn't. But the crimes, the political crimes that were committed, under apartheid and the opposition against apartheid, were equally heinous. Many of them were heinous. There were only three conditions that were stipulated by the commission. The one was a political motive. The crimes had to have a political motive. And the applicants had to give full disclosure of all the crimes that they had committed, including the lines of command and so forth. And finally, the crimes had to be proportional to the political motive that they were claiming.
So clearly there were people whose crimes were not proportional and people who are...
Well, that was this proportionality clause is the most complicated, I think, of all the conditions of the commission, because so many of these people who were operating under apartheid would claim political motive for murdering an activist and then for burning them and throwing their ashes into the rivers of some of the rivers of South Africa. Now, where is proportionality there? And yet, some of them were granted amnesty. Many of those who were responsible for these unspeakable crimes under apartheid were granted amnesty on the basis that their crimes were committed under political motive.
Well, speaking of unspeakable crimes, that brings us to Eugene de Kock, the man who headed a government death squad during the apartheid era and who appeared before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He was, of course, also brought up on criminal charges. He's still in prison today.
Yes, he is.
And
he's serving. Yeah.
Go ahead.
He's serving 212 years and two life sentences. He has applied for presidential pardon. He was refused amnesty for some of his crimes, but granted amnesty for the majority of his crimes. Now there is a conversation in South Africa about his possible release on presidential pardon.
And that may happen as soon as next week.
Yes.
What do you think? You interviewed him at great length. Your book is in large measure a dialogue between you and Eugene de Kock.
Yes. I at the end of my interviews, which lasted more than 46 hours over a period of 3 months, I was searching throughout those interviews, searching to find the evil in de Kock. And I must say that when I approached him, when I started the interviews with him, I was really driven by a sense of hope in humanity, that even with the history of the atrocities that he had committed, that it was possible to salvage some sense of humanity in him. And that was born out of an experience that I had with him after he had been forgiven by widows of victims that he had murdered. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of those interviews, I was convinced that de Kock was a man who was really struggling with the atrocities that he had committed, that he was beginning to seek out a new life and to seek out a relationship with the very people that he had spent his entire life trying to destroy. And it occurred in my mind that many of these crimes are committed because of specific evil systems, that the system of apartheid was a terrible system, it was an oppressive system that nurtured people like Eugene de Kock, and gave them reason to commit these atrocities, precisely because it was defined as a system that defied all morality, all moral codes. And it was within this system that these people were operating. And so now that South African society was looking into a more human newness, Eugene de Kock was embracing this moment, was embracing this newness. And that is what was hopeful for me. Not many of these perpetrators were able to express a sense of remorse like Eugene de Kock did. This was very unusual. But when they did, one did have a sense of trust in the process, trust in a process that was enabling even the most evil people like de Kock to reach out in the depths of their conscience to begin to feel a sense of remorse and regret and to start a new life. And that's what restoration is about. That's really the essence of reconciliation. Reconciliation is not simply about black and white meeting together, establishing a relationship between black and white. It's about restoring humanness in a society that has been ravaged by so much conflict in the past.
Our guest is Pumla Gobodo-Madikizela. Her book is A Human Being Died That Night. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Elise, who's with us from East Lansing in Michigan.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much.
Hello, Elise.
I would like to ask you how all the rest of us can use forgiveness. How can we be helped to use forgiveness in, for ourselves and to other people?
Thank you, Elise. Forgiveness is has been seen by many people as unattainable. Many people think, perceive it as purely a Christian notion, which it is historically. But I think forgiveness is the conversation about forgiveness is a very secular conversation. Mm-hmm. It's really about re-establishing human relationships. When these break down, we do not see one another as human beings. We dehumanize one another. And I think often we want to hold on to the hatred and resentment because we think that we are giving power back to the people who have hurt us. And yet once we negotiate and consider the possibility of forgiveness, it becomes clear to us that forgiveness is not just about re-empowering perpetrators or making them go free, allowing them to go free. It empowers the people who have been hurt themselves. It restores dignity and a sense of control to the people who have been hurt. And is a healthy alternative to punishing other people with violence. Mm-hmm. And violence recreates cycles of hatreds and resentment and carries down from generation to generation. And if it is not arrested in the way that I believe we attempted to do in South Africa, then the cycles of hatred are going to repeat themselves and they often become very aggressive and people become aggressive against one another.
Just following up on Elise's point, in exactly what you're saying, I mean, it seems on the surface a very altruistic exercise of forgiveness. Mm. It's a very practical matter, isn't it?
Mm, yes, it is. It's very practical because, if you think about it, you open your mind to the possibility of cleansing, to speak in a figurative way, cleansing what was damaged. And so allowing oneself to consider, at least to begin to consider that it is possible to clear the air and to engage in dialogue with another person, simply to engage with dialogue, I think opens the door to the possibility of forgiveness. And what destroys that possibility is when all doors are shut down, that the shutting down communication and dealing only in terms of violence doesn't open up this possibility of engaging with others, inviting others to engage in a more peaceful way that may or may not lead to forgiveness.
Elise, thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Elise.
God bless you.
Thank you.
And we just have a few seconds before we have to go to a break, but another element of practicality in the context of South Africa, if you were to punish everyone who was guilty of something, where would it stop?
Mm-hmm. And we see examples in countries like Rwanda where it has, they started off with punishing, which they had to. One has to hold both these tensions together and see what works best. But for practical purposes, the forgiveness route, or if you may, the dialogue route, which is what really opens the door to forgiveness, is the useful one.
We're talking about South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission after the end of apartheid, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Our guest is Phumla Gobodo-Madikizela. She was a member of the Commission's Human Rights Violations Committee. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about the legacy of the Commission's work, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us totn@npr.org. Of course, we were talking about perpetrators, but many victims, as was mentioned, testified before the commission and provided their testimony. Joining our conversation now is Jude Clark, a lecturer at the School of Psychology at the University of Durban-Westville in South Africa. She conducted interviews with several women who testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and she joins us from Manchester, England, and it's very nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
First of all, can you tell us a little bit about the women you spoke with? What types of stories did they have for the commission?
I think that there were two main defining characteristics of the testimony given by the women I spoke to. And I think I need to state that I make no claim at generalizing this to every woman who participated in the TRC process. This is simply the women that were part of my research process. But the first thing is that the stories were gendered. So most of the women were speaking of events in their lives that were painful, human rights violations. Let me give an example. One of the women I spoke to, let's call her Mrs. Lamini, 61 years old, mother, grandmother, told her story at the TRC and spoke of an attack on her family homestead in the late 80s and spoke to me 12 years after this event. In the middle of the night, with most of the family and extended family asleep, armed men had entered the home. Uncertainty of whom these attackers could be, of course, either former SA Defense Force soldiers or members of an opposing political party. In that attack on the homestead, her son was killed, and family members, including Mrs. Lamini, were shot and wounded. And so basically the stories that the women went to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission were around events in which menfolk were killed, mm-hmm. were disappeared, were tortured, and in some cases, these women themselves detained.
And after, one of the things you did was talk to them after their testimony. What did some of them say about their experience in hindsight?
Well, there was a little bit of ambivalence about their participation and how they had experienced it. There was a feeling of unfinished business. If I use the example of the same woman I was speaking of, in retrospect, she wished that there had been space and opportunity to talk about a lot more than an event, you know, more than a specific event, perhaps, to place herself more centrally and her story more centrally in her testimony rather than speaking about her son or her husband. Mm-hmm. The things that she says were heavy on her heart, that she wished she could have spoken about those things.
I understand that not every woman was able to tell the complete story before the commission.
Well, certainly the way these women described it, they weren't able to.
Because of...
They felt, in retrospect.
Why?
Well, one of the things is that the difficulty of talking about private, there's still a very rigid distinction between the private and public. And there were certain things, particularly around sexual violation, that women had extreme difficulty speaking about, almost experienced as a visceral difficulty of not being able to make the words form and come out to certain cultural directives that says that African women are strong, that you don't mm-hmm. talk about certain things, that you cope like everyone else around you. A few other reasons as well.
Yeah, things that are very difficult to talk about for everybody, of course.
Oh, sure, yes.
Given their ambivalence about their experience, do they still believe in the process?
Well, certainly that's part of the ambivalence, is that there's still hope in that processes like the TRC hold enormous potential. There's this feeling that even though there are some problems with it, that we need to talk. And the women say that we talk like this every day, that women, as women, we share our problems, we share our difficulties, but we need to do this more on an everyday basis. There need to be channels where we can talk about our pain and the things that cause it. I think one of the difficulties for these women was the discourse of the past that closed off any possibility about talking about very real problems in the present. And these are psychological problems and social problems to do with socioeconomic status and circumstance as well.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Jude Clark is a lecturer in the School of Psychology at the University of Durban, Westville in South Africa. She spoke with us by phone from Manchester, England. And Pumla Gobodo-Madikizela, the word that many of us wish we would never hear again, I think that's one of the things that Jude Clark was talking about. Closure. There is no closure.
Mm. Oh, no. There can never be closure. The healing process is really a process. Even as Jude talks about other issues related that don't seem to be related to the original trauma, the issues of socioeconomic depravity, mm-hmm. unemployment, and now AIDS and HIV, which affect in large part women. We just had recently in South Africa a study that found that women are dying at alarming rates, alarmingly high rates, and at a younger age. So when we talk about the past, we really are talking about several layers of pain that people continue to deal with. But in spite of all of that, it is possible to see the hope in a process that tried to resolve the problems of the past. But the realization is that the past lives with us, continues to live with us. The challenge is, how do we live with such a tragic past without reenacting some of the responses of the past that characterize that past? And as we deal in South Africa with the problem of HIV/AIDS, that is the question that I think the challenge that faces South Africa today is not so much the past as in the political past. It's really the private lives and issues of social inequality, because this is really what most women are dealing with. The AIDS issue is not just a medical problem. It's a cultural problem where men are sort of allowed by the culture to have multiple relationships. Now, how can you separate the experiences of the past under apartheid from the current experiences of suffering faced by so many communities in South Africa? You cannot. And so in talking about this past, one is to remember that the memories of suffering of the past are intertwined with the current experiences of suffering and pain.
Let's get some more callers on the line. Brad is with us from South Bend, Indiana.
Yeah, hi. I was when you were talking about the remorse of Mr. de Kock a little while ago, it made me think about the issue of restitution, where a lot of the complaint mm-hmm. about the issue of restitution is that people can just sort of pay back money or, you know, pay for these crimes and sort of settle everything without having to feel remorse, without having mm-hmm. to feel a sense of a change of heart or whatever, and that restitution has this sort of negative effect. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. if what she thinks about restitution, whether that should be an issue that is explored or you know, whether mm-hmm. apologies and remorse are more important to strive after.
The best route, I think, in these situations is to try and hold both of these positions, the restitution position as well as a position of restoration, which comes with apologies and remorse on the part of perpetrators. They should not be mutually exclusive. But in South Africa, there was no requirement for perpetrators to pay compensation as such. The government itself had put together a plan of reparations, of paying reparations, compensation to victims. So, you know, in a way, one might say that, well, these apologies and remorse are empty in the absence of restitution on the part of that is required for these perpetrators. But, you know, I think that these processes are not perfect. Restitutions have got their place, because people do need to see that the other person is giving up something to pay, as it were, for the hurt that they have caused. But there is a hollowness in that when it's sort of, as you say, it's just giving out money. There is no real sense of connecting with the other person. I think that the success story of these processes would be when both sides occur, both of these positions happen at the same time, that there's restitution at the same time, there is remorse, there's a reaching out to the other person, a recognition that the person has caused pain from the heart, not only materially. And that is the most, for me, that is the most meaningful connection that can happen after these incidents.
Brad, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Let's go now to Troy, and Troy's on the line with us from Iowa City.
Yes, I am. Hey, I got a question for you. Willie Mandela's bodyguards were convicted of torturing and killing a boy named Stumpy.
Stumpy McKenzie, yes.
Yes. And when she went to in front of the commission, she never did confess to ordering them to do that. Does she deserve amnesty?
I talk about that in my book and reflect on that moment in the history of the Truth Commission as a sad moment. Sad because Winnie was Madikizela Mandela. Was held up as the mother of the nation. She led the struggle against apartheid when Nelson Mandela was in prison, along with other women and men. And it was said that she wasn't able to rise above the sort of blatant denials that she didn't know what was going on. And even when she did apologize, it was at the urging of Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Now, does she deserve amnesty? She did not apply for amnesty. If she were to apply for amnesty, she would be she would be as deserving as so many of the apartheid perpetrators are deserving of amnesty, and many of whom have been granted amnesty. There is no distinction between who deserves amnesty.
So do you think she should be tried for murdering Stumpy then, because she has not admitted?
Well, there was a case, a trial, and there were consequences for her after that trial.
Why?
Now, as to whether she should be tried, the law that was established to guide the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission states very clearly that people who have not applied for amnesty are liable to prosecution. If they have committed atrocities and they have not applied for amnesty, they are liable for prosecution. If they did not receive amnesty, they are equally liable for prosecution.
And Troy, keep it.
So will you step up and ask for her to be prosecuted?
I am a professor at the University of Cape Town right now. People have a right to pursue. To pursue requests for prosecutions for people that they believe deserve to be prosecuted, and that is an open question right now.
We're speaking with Pumla Gobodo Madikizela. Her book is A Human Being Died That Night, A South African Woman Confronts the Legacy of Apartheid. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Lizza, and Lizza's with us from Washington, D.C.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was lucky enough to be in South Africa in 1996 as a law student at WITS, and I was able to attend some of the commission's early hearings in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really struck me while I was there, I attended the hearings. I'm a white American woman, and I attended the hearings with a Ghanaian woman who was also in the law classes that I was in. And as we attended this together, which to the two of us was sort of no big deal, that night we saw ourselves on television on all of the news broadcasts because it was sort of dramatic to have a white woman and a black woman sitting there obviously together and talking and observing this. And what I'm wondering is, as part of as the efforts to continue restoring humanity on the kind of baby step level, is it still so dramatic, or has there been progress and has there been a change in the sort of day-to-day interactions among blacks and whites in South Africa and Indians?
Thanks, Lisa. There is a change in the atmosphere, in the way people talk about race. There's an easiness now in talking about race. It doesn't mean that there aren't issues of racism. The divisions between black and white, I think, will continue in South Africa for a long time, because apartheid, the laws of apartheid ensured that the geographic separation between black and white. So black people continue to live in black areas and whites in suburbs. Only a few black people who can afford to move into suburbs move there. So the divisions are still there, but at the level of conversations, South Africans found, through the commission's work, found new ways of talking to one another and are still learning to talk to one another. And I think that is the greatest, one of the greatest outcomes from the Truth Commission, has been the ability to find language, to talk about the difficult things that define the history of this country, and so black and white people now, there is an enthusiasm, a great enthusiasm, to reach across the color line. There's still tensions in some places, and people are struggling to move out of their attitudinal boxes, but there is this urgency, it seems to me, the urgency to discover who the other group is. When I move, travel into the far-lying areas in the Overberg, in the very Afrikaner parts of the country, I am amazed at how Afrikaners are so desirous of reaching out and knowing black people. Now, these are areas where the whites only know black people who work in their kitchens or on their farms. But there is such a hunger. I find that there is such a hunger among so many of these communities to really reach out to black people.
Lisa, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, we'll wrap up our conversation on the legacy of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. And we'll also talk about a new and very different psychological assessment of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, the Columbine killers. If you'd like to join that conversation, 800-989-8255, TOTN@NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the legacy of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa with Phumla Gobodo-Madikizela, who was a member of the Human Rights Commission and author of the book A Human Being Died That Night, A South African Woman Confronts the Legacy of Apartheid. And let's get another call in. This is Patty, who's with us from Drexelville, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm calling because it's been... That same thing has been proposed for the north of Ireland.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, yes.
And I don't know how the blacks in South Africa could have been forgiving and done this, you know, like not seeing them prosecuted, not seeing them, you know.
Let some people get amnesty for their crimes, in other words.
I mean, I want to see Britain suffer for what they did to the people in Northern Ireland. They, you know, they have not even been, nothing has been done about even the 14 people that were killed on Bloody Sunday. They spent millions of dollars in an investigation in which they don't even admit that they did anything wrong. You know, I don't understand how...
And let me just put that to Pumla Gobodo Madikizela, Sharpeville, many more people, how did people come to terms with this?
It's really just confronting the reality that if we wish harm upon, if the response to these terrible deeds is wishing harm upon others, is wishing others to be imprisoned or to suffer the same consequences that we did, that it doesn't build. So South Africa was concerned about building a society guided by rules of compassion and empathy for others. Now, it doesn't mean that people are not angry, but what it does mean is that when the other side is able to acknowledge wrongdoing publicly and to admit wrong and to apologize for what they did, there is a sense of in which that invites forgiveness in itself. It invites forgiveness. Now, that's the first thing I want to say about that. The other thing I want to say is that Nelson Mandela and so many other leaders like Stephen Biko, throughout their struggles, one of the things that they were they came back to constantly was rebuilding the humanness, what we call in my language Ubuntu, which literally means the humanity, bringing back the humanity back to the South African society. Now, these were leaders who were defining the responses that we see today, even in those days when life in South Africa was violent. They constantly reminded society that we have to bring back the humanity into our society. Apartheid and the white rulers of apartheid destroyed that humanness. Our goal as leaders of black people is to restore humanity back to the community, to the society of South Africa. And this is indeed what happened. And South Africa, I believe, is healthier for it, for not holding on to the hatred, for not returning the evil of apartheid, for not insisting on creating more victims among white society. We are the healthier for it, all of us as South Africans, black and white.
Patty, thanks very much.
Can I speak to that? In the north of Ireland, the parties like Sinn Féin and SDLP, they say they don't want to do to the unionists and loyalists what have been done to them. It is the unionists and loyalists who refuse to even acknowledge that they have done anything wrong.
Okay. Which is why acknowledgement is so critical when people are dealing with these past atrocities. It's an accountability, a sense of an accountability.
An email question, I'm going to have to ask you to keep your answer brief if you could, from Jane in Des Moines, Iowa. Are there lessons from South Africa's experience with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that might be transferable or helpful to Iraq's history of torture and political recrimination?
It is this very point about public accountability, that if there is no public accountability, then it is likely that victims become perpetrators again, that the process of accountability, acknowledgement and public accountability turns back those cycles of violence that so often repeat themselves historically.
Pumla Gobodo Madikizela, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
I knew I'd mess it up. Pumla Gobodo Madikizela's book is A Human Being Died That Night, A South African Woman Confronts the Legacy of Apartheid. She joined us from our bureau in New York.